You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Delta Quadrant Podcast, part of the Trekmate Family.
You're listening to The Delta Quadrant, a Star Trek Voyager podcast. This is a podcast where we review episodes of Star Trek Voyager in the order in which they were broadcast. Tonight's episode is Prey. This is Matt from Arizona.
I'm Ben from Arizona.
This is Melissa from North Dakota.
And Gino in Oklahoma.
And it is just the four of us tonight, the original Delta Quadrant bunch, and we're just going to be talking about the final chapter in this trilogy of awesome, Prey. So, because we have no guests, there's no interview section, so we can just jump right into it. Prey is the short synopsis on Memory Alpha says, Voyager rescues a critically ill Hirogen hunter who wishes to finish his hunt against a resilient species, a recent enemy of the Voyager crew, as Captain Janeway gives 7 of 9 a lesson in compassion. This is the 16th episode of Season 4 of Star Trek Voyager, first aired February 18th, 1998. It was written by Brandon Braga and directed by Alan Eastman. The guest stars this week include Clint Carmichael as Hirogen Hunter and the special guest star, the Candyman himself, Tony Todd, as the Alpha Hirogen. Melissa, our very own Melissa, has the notes for us this week. So Melissa, whenever you're ready, take us into Prey.
Well, tonight we open with two Hirogen on their ship. They are chasing down a challenging prey. The Alpha instructs the Beta, the way a creature behaves when it is wounded is the key to its destruction. The prey makes its final stand on an asteroid. The two Hirogen apply their stripes and head out to make the kill. Stalking through the dust and rock, the prey jumps out. It's species 8472, and in moments, it's dead. A flawless kill.
Now, have we seen this cave system before?
It's the planet Hellset.
It's always the same cave system. I'm pretty sure those were the same caves that Picard and Beverly were crawling through when Picard got captured by the Cardassian.
Oh, no, they are. They are. They the TNG crew nicknamed that set Planet Hell, and it's just been the same cave set ever since.
Yeah.
I mean, I was expecting to see Janeway's pain face all over that thing.
I don't know when we're going to see pain face again, but I'm sure it's coming up soon.
You know, Gino, Ben had just forgotten about that.
I had just forgotten about it.
How could you forget about it? It's posted all over the brig.
I try my best.
It's like half the wallpaper down there.
Well, I guess you have to go to the brig before you can see the brig. Hey, so guys, they have some like very Men in Black looking guns, the Hirogen do. And I know this is the same set from Hunters and whatnot, although we get to see a lot more of it. I mean, are there any thoughts on the design of the ship? There were some things like their scanning devices didn't seem to be readouts. They seem to be, I don't know, like HUD devices or something. The guns are cool, you know, and ready for battle and whatnot. I mean, do we have any final thoughts? Because this is the last time we're going to see this ship.
One thing I did notice about the guns is the fact that their scanning is on the gun itself. Normally, a Starfleet member would have a tricorder individually. I was thinking that the writers probably thought of this beforehand in that this is a hunting species. Their main piece of equipment when they go somewhere is their gun, whereas in Starfleet, you're not always armed, but you do have a device to scan.
You know what it reminded me of is the little motion tracker thing from Aliens? That sort of thing?
Yeah, I could see that. You know, and we saw them put some paint on last episode. I mean, it wasn't quite as obvious. I mean, they make more of a deal of it here, different colors, I'm assuming for different roles and whatnot. And I'm kind of intrigued, you know, they're giving us a lot of these little visual pieces about their culture, and I'm really excited to learn more about them.
I really love this species. I know I said this last week, but this is probably the most excited I've been about a Voyager villain since the Vidians. I just think these guys are real, real interesting. I love their guns, by the way. And just a little side note, if any of you have played the computer game Star Trek Voyager Elite Force, their gun is one of the playable guns in that game, and it's badass. I loved playing with that gun.
Yeah. You know, so Tony Todd obviously has a very distinguished voice, and I'm glad he's here. I will say, though, that the Hirogen look a bit smaller. So
I noticed that too.
It's a bit of a detraction from that original mystery and intrigue to him, but I understand, you know, production-wise, there's not a million seven-foot dudes running.
That's
around.
What I was gonna say. And Tony, it's not like Tony Todd is petite. You know, he's
no,
still
right.
And what he lacks for in size, he makes up for with that Candyman voice. So
he does have a good voice.
He does tower over Chakotay and the rest of them, though, later when they're in the corridor. I mean, he's a lot taller than they all are.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You really get the feeling, I think, with the Hirogen that they completely thought out this race before they introduced them, because right off the bat, they've got a lot of history. We know a lot about their culture, which we get introduced to more in this episode. But just like you were mentioning with the way the ship looks and the interactions that we get between the Hirogen crew themselves, you can just tell that the writers have put some thought into them.
Oh yeah, this is no L.A. street gang Kazon lameness here. This is pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I do find it also interesting that it seems that all their ships are two-person craft. So mm-hmm. That was another cool thing too.
And only men. Yet somehow the species survives.
I want you to remember that statement, Ben, because they do, unfortunately, I think, for my money, change that about the Hirogen in later episodes. They're two-person hunting parties.
Right.
Well, next up, the Doctor and Seven are in sickbay for their first session of Miss Manners. It doesn't go quite as well as the Doctor had hoped.
Please remain still so that I can treat your injuries. Thank you. I'm sorry, did that hurt? I'll try to be more careful. Thanks for being a patient. Have a pleasant afternoon. This is absurd.
Not at all. Keep going. You're doing fine.
This vernacular is not applicable to my duties on Voyager.
We can tailor the vocabulary to your specific situations a little later. Right now, it's the sentiment that counts.
I don't see the relevance.
I created these exercises 3 years ago to familiarize myself with the social graces. I found that if I repeated them several times each day, the words became almost second nature. Let's continue. Exercise 2. The workplace encounter. Kes used to help you with this one. Now, I'll be the nurse, you be the doctor.
Please hand me the hypospray.
Of course, doctor. Immediately.
Thank you. Looks at instrument.
No, don't read that part. Only the dialogue.
Excuse me, nurse. This is the wrong hypospray. Would you mind finding the correct one?
Not at all.
Thank you. Did I mention you look lovely today?
Oh, doctor, you're so charming.
This lesson is terminated.
Okay, rookie mistake reading the direction.
I like the fact that the doctor mentioned Kes and that this was something that she used to work with him on. I thought it was nice to bring that connection into the scene.
Well, now the doctor's taken his next step forward. Now it's a role reversal. He used to be the one being taught the social niceties of working with humans, and now it's his turn to teach the student.
See, I thought we had agreed not to talk about Kes anymore.
I don't remember that rule.
Well, then you better be absent in a couple of seasons from now when she comes back for that terrible, terrible episode.
Wait, Gino doesn't know that yet, Matt.
I feel connection problems coming on already.
All right, moving on from Seven and the Doctor. On the bridge, a single Hirogen ship is spotted, dead in the water. Chakotay is suspicious. Seven is ready to take it out. But Janeway, ever the believer in the SWOT analysis, decides to turn this threat into an opportunity and check it out. Chakotay, Paris, who, by the way, his hair looks particularly poofy in this episode.
I wanted to stop you right there. Something's got to be up. He looks like, has he maybe gained a little weight?
I think he has.
He's looking a little bit different here, and it seems like a big change from the last episode.
I'm not going to say anything because I'm not exactly, you know, fit myself, but over the course of 7 years, you do see Robert Duncan McNeil get fatter and fatter.
I didn't notice the rest of him. I just thought his hair looked poofy. I don't know.
His
Maybe
hair
it's just
was
the lighting.
Poofy, but something about his uniform in this episode just seemed to fit him awkwardly. I don't know what the deal was.
Well, I think
Janeway's
looking
great, but Paris just, for some reason, not fitting the uniform today.
Well, while we're paused here, I do want to ask Ben, because last season when we were talking about Unity, and I remember you saying you were so in support of Janeway's decision to not just run from the dead Borg ship, but to board it and find out more information. And I kind of feel like she's doing the same thing here. So what do you think of this command decision? I was curious to get your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think it's in character. I mean, we saw her do this in Message in a Bottle as well, you know, quick to action. So, I mean, this is one of these fundamental character traits of Janeway I really, really enjoy. I mean, it reminds me of Kirk. It's like spring to action, you know. So it's one of my favorite qualities she has. Gino, you're right. She's beautiful. Yeah. I don't know what they've done to her hair. It must be like a small tweak or something to that nature. Or maybe it's her playing the action leader. Maybe the confidence she's exuding. But something about her is supremely attractive.
I think it's... I forget the names of the episodes. When Neelix was having his existential crisis.
Mortal Coil.
Okay. I think from that point, she's been looking great. Like, she's fit. Her hair looks great for her shape. She is in prime condition here.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I like... You know, I just, in general, all these character traits are things I love about Janeway. And if, for my money, that's the same thing I would do, too. I mean, why not
ten
Starfleet officers over with phasers? I mean, it's only one person, so
why not? Well, I think what we're getting at here, this is the year of hell, Janeway.
Yeah, but like we've seen in Unity, and I'm telling you, all the way throughout, I mean, they kept this part of her character. This is something I think guys will rub up against when they see a woman in command here. They rub up against this... These things, you know. So, but I appreciate it. I think it's one of her best qualities.
I do too. She may not always make the best decisions. I mean, she's always quick to make them. There's no hemming and hawing with Janeway.
Yeah, she's very solid about her choices.
Well, and I think actually later on in this episode we see some really clear evidence of some confusion with her character, but. Back to Chakotay, Paris, and Tuvok. They beam over to investigate to the Hiroshian ship. All is quiet. There are no sounds, save the bubbling soup pot, filled with the remains of a number of different species. Paris discovers a pile of armor. He picks up the helmet. Cue the music. It's a decapitated head.
Dun, dun, dun!
I love this whole scene, by the way. It's so like a horror movie.
It is. It is. And Tuvok's tricorder picks up life signs, leading the away team to discover a surviving Hiroshian, injured and cowering in a corner.
What they didn't show us in this scene here was Chakotay downloading a database, I don't believe. Which I thought was interesting when it came back up later, because I started to wonder where they got all this information. And they threw a tagline in there. But they told it didn't show, which drives me nuts.
Well, I don't need to necessarily show him manipulating controls and doing all this other crap. They come up with the technobabble solution so often on this show that when they say they downloaded the database, I just take it as such.
So do you think these Hiroshian are eating their kill?
That's a very good assumption.
I think so.
Really, you think that? See, because I don't get that. That's not what I'm getting from this.
I don't think they necessarily eat everything. The number one, everything is a trophy. But
is trophies. They've got these hanging bones all over the ship. But what are you going to do with all this decayable flesh? Why not get rid of it in an efficient manner?
Right, but in the last episode, they mentioned that the trophy from 709 would be her long coiled intestine.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not always the bones they're saving. Yeah. So I'm just curious. I was just curious about it because as hunters, you know, personally... I've always been brought up with you eat what you kill because that's why you go hunting. So I'm wondering if they're trying to mirror that here or if they're trying to show waste. I'm not quite sure what they're getting at. So.
I never took them as that kind of hunters, Ben. I would say I always compared the Hiroshian more to like the most dangerous game, that story. That's what I think of the Hiroshian as.
Okay.
Well, I think given that they're what we're going to find out about in the next scene is that their whole culture is based on this, I would find it hard to believe that with an entire cultural, religious society based on hunting, that they wouldn't eat something that they're killing. Can you imagine a hunter-gatherer society that doesn't eat any of their prey? That wouldn't make any sense.
I don't see them as those types of hunters.
You don't?
Okay. No, I see them more as, to relate it to our world here, I would see it more as like hitmen or assassins. That's where their culture kind of... that's kind of the basis of their culture I'm coming from. Okay. That turned into, like, who's the best assassin, who's the best hunter, the best killer.
Okay. What's the deal with the war paint? Is that ever explained?
Well, next up, we have a staff meeting, and I think we should get to it, because this is where Chakotay becomes a sociologist, and he describes the hunter culture of the Hirogen to everybody. He talks about the fact that, again, their religion, their culture, you know, their whole society, their authority structure, it's all based around the hunt. So you can imply lots of different things with that.
I have an interpretation for Gino, just how I always interpreted the paint, and actually reading Voyager novels that had to do with the Hirogen. I know that's not canon, but it's a good interpretation, is when they paint themselves, they're signifying that they're actively on the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does it have anything to do with a sort of rank system? Because in the previous couple of episodes, we've seen Alpha Hirogen put on white paint.
Right.
And this one,
that's probably it, because I think Tony Todd is wearing white paint, too.
Mm-hmm. One of them wore white, and the other one wore red.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some inconsistencies. I'm not sure if it really matters or means anything. But yeah, you're right, Melissa. I mean, these guys are like a pack of wolves. It's exactly... This is the... You know, if you were to kind of think of a society, a culture, you would almost have to go into that culture. I mean, that
I think Chakotay pronounces it woofs at one point. Like a pack of woofs.
I don't think he does. He says wolves.
He just directs this line at Janeway, like, you know what I'm talking about. Like, woofs, right?
But it's a good question, too. I mean, we saw what kills the Borg, you know? Mm-hmm. And now we got the question of who hunts the hunters. And it's a good one. I mean, I think of all the great baddies out there, 8472 is top-notch.
Let's get back to 8472, because this is our first reappearance of them since Scorpion.
In sick bay, it's not looking good for the Hirogen. Janeway comes to meet with her prisoner.
Your crewmate is dead. And your ship has been damaged beyond repair. I brought you here to treat your injuries. What happened to your ship? Who attacked you? Well, the first time I met your species, it wasn't on the best of terms. But that doesn't mean you and I can't find a way to change that.
Our prey.
You were on a hunt.
Yes. A formidable alien. We captured it 2 days ago. But it broke free of its restraints, attacked us. Release me. I must continue the hunt.
Not without your ship, and not in this condition. You'll die without treatment. Let us help you.
I want to point out, this is the first time we see a Hirogen without a helmet on. If you look at his head, he's got wide ridges on either side, but you can see the distinct V in the middle. If you know anything about brain physiology, granted, the Hirogen might be built different than humans, yes, but however, the frontal lobe has a lot to do with that fight-or-flight response and the aggressive tendencies, which would say that the Hirogen in this case are not exactly aggressive, as they are a pensive hunting race, so they're very calculated.
With a large medulla oblongata. It makes crocodiles angry.
Well, they're angry because they got all them teeth and no toothbrush.
Back on the bridge, something strange is going on. The sensors report damage to the hull, and Kim and Tuvok are sent to check it out.
Commander. It's a dense mixture of DNA and polyfluidic compounds. Tuvok to bridge.
Go ahead.
We may have an intruder on board. I'm analyzing what could be a sample of its blood. The readings are consistent with species 8472.
Intruder alert. Bridge to security. Seal off decks 10 through 12.
Internal sensors aren't detecting any intruders.
The last time we ran into this species, it was impervious to our scanners. We'll have to track it visually.
How did it get past our shields?
Worry about that later. You have the bridge, Commander. I'll be on deck 11.
Now, you'll notice the way we respond to the mention of species 8472 now is just as we used to respond when the first initiation was with the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
The first couple of times we met them on Next Generation, somebody mentions the Borg and you quarantine the ship. It's kind of the same thing now with these guys.
Why not? Did you see what they did last time?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting, though, you bring that up, Gino, because 8472 is not the threat on this ship.
No.
And
they don't know that yet, though.
Well, I understand, but in the beginning scene, it's very Starfleet of the whole, let me help you, let us help you.
I agree. We're treating way too much compassion here.
Well, it's not so much that. It is. I just like to point out, why are they... So Starfleet obviously recognizes the Borg were dangerous. They recognize Species 8472 were dangerous. Why can't they, with all their wisdom and interactions with Species, recognize how dangerous and... Not because they're big and powerful or super awesome weapons, but because of the mentality of this culture is so foreign to Starfleet. The way this culture looks at people in Starfleet is so different. The danger is that it is the greatest. I mean, at least the Borg are colonizers. I mean, Starfleet kind of gets that. At least 8472 is responding to, you know, with overwhelming force to a, you know, mortal threat. Starfleet understands that. Starfleet does not understand these people, and I think it's...
You're talking about the Hirogen.
I am talking about the Hirogen. And so Starfleet doesn't understand them. So they are the true threat here.
See,
they
I
are
really...
the true threat. I think we should have put him in the brig as soon as his wounds were healed.
The reason maybe that I could offer that they were more willing to deal with the Hirogen than 8472 or whatever is because I would think as humans we think, we may foolishly think, that if we interact with a species that interacts with us, like there's two-way communication, we could possibly make a breakthrough. Last time with 8472, it was they were using Kes. I know you don't want me to mention her, but Kes was like a portal, and she would try to talk back to them, but they were mostly ignored. They, you know, the weak will perish, all that good stuff. So I don't know. Maybe in Janeway's mind, she thinks that maybe somehow they can establish some sort of common ground with this Hirogen because at least it's willing to interact with them. 8472 in the past has not been the most interactive and quick to become hostile. So maybe that's the thinking there. I don't know.
So if more to it, and I'm going to keep rebacking up here because now it makes sense. On the bridge, originally when we talked about Janeway going to an action and everything, Seven questioned Janeway. Now that's going to be a big theme throughout from here on out. She said that was the wrong decision. They show no regard for human life. They show no willingness to communicate or deal with us. They are a threat. They should be destroyed. Mm-hmm. You guys know how I feel about the Borg, so I'm kind of with Seven on this here. But Janeway says, everything in my experience tells me that we have to take the chance. So I'm curious why... I find it curious that Starfleet is willing to take chances sometimes, but not others. That's just kind of where I'm at here at this by this time of this scene.
Well, and also, if you consider Starfleet's last interaction with Species 8472, they essentially created a genocidal weapon against them. There's no reason for Species 8472 to have any compassion on them. In fact, the exact opposite is true.
Well, actually, I look at it a little different. I see it as Starfleet likes to be overpowered. So Starfleet, once they have the upper hand, they know they do. Now it's when Starfleet's like, okay, you know, we'll just raise shields. We won't arm phasers and torpedoes. We see Picard do that a lot. So to me, I'm still not understanding. Once again, you know, we defeated 8472. We have the way to defeat them. I'm not understanding this risk assessment here. It seems a little odd to me.
But one thing I do like, and this speaks to your point about Janeway being an action person, Ben, I do like the fact that even though it's probably risky for her to risk her own life, I do like that she takes charge and wants to go down there herself. It is. And when we get to this engineering scene that I don't know if Melissa's going to narrate or not, but this the thing I like about 8472 is that it is, I think for my money, it's pretty scary. I mean, the way it just leaps at people and can burst out of walls and just is very agile. I mean, it almost does kind of remind me of the alien from Alien in that sort of sense.
Now, we already passed the exterior shot of it on the outside of Voyager, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool.
That was a cool shot. Yeah, granted, all CG, but...
As Matt mentioned, in engineering, everybody's busy trying to lock down the ship from their intruder. Standing at the warp engine, B'Elanna gets that funny feeling someone's looking at her. She looks up, and 8472 drops from the ceiling.
Right. Exactly, but it's a very, you can see it's a very, like, alien thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And they kind of retcon how it got in there. It's through an antimatter injector.
Well, this probably winds B'Elanna up in sickbay. So back there again, Janeway and Seven update the Hirogen prisoner on their intruder. Seven wants Mr. 8472 dead, but Janeway wants to take a more gentle approach.
I'll modify the phaser rifles to fire nanoprobe discharges.
I want you to incapacitate the creature, not kill it. Can you make that modification?
Yes, but it would require additional time. We must stop it as soon as possible.
She's right.
Not until we know why it returned.
You will be exposing this crew to unnecessary risk.
I disagree.
Captain.
You have your orders, Seven. Six of your vessels will be here in under 4 hours. I hope you'll let them know that we saved your life, and that we want to avoid any further conflict with your people.
Let me resume the hunt, and I will grant your request.
We have enough problems on this ship as it is without him running around.
I spent 6 months studying this prey's behavior. I know how to track him. Let me continue, or I will have the others destroy you.
Now, I think this is partially the reason that we're giving him this leniency here, is that, yes, we found a way to destroy Species 8472, sure, but Starfleet is also kind of saying they, one, are probably one of the most powerful races in this area, so it's better to be friendly to them than fighting with them, because they could take us out, because they have a lot of numbers, and two, they're pretty much in control of the network that we were just using to communicate with Starfleet, which is currently down at the moment.
It blowed up.
That's true. I want to defend Seven here for a moment, because in her defense, I think she has every right to think Janeway is nuts. Because her experience of Janeway, what's her first experience of Janeway, was from Scorpion, where Janeway was willing to commit genocide to save herself. And so Seven just simply cannot comprehend why this woman is suddenly so compassionate and so willing to take risks. It's a complete flip for Janeway from Seven's perspective, and quite frankly from our perspective as well, as the viewers. So I think Seven has every right to expect different responses from Janeway in this.
I'm surprised to hear you defending Seven of Nine, but I'm kind of with you. I'm going to be on the side of Seven for most of this episode, but probably for different reasons than you are.
So I'm actually going to be not on Seven's side at all here. Here's why. Because 8472 is not a threat. It's wounded. We don't necessarily know that at this moment in time. We do know the hunter's been hunting it. They did say that they thought they had incapacitated it, but it had, like, you know, resurrected or something. Let's contain it. Let's deal with it. But I am with Janeway here on the we need not to destroy it because they are so powerful.
Okay.
Because if you make one friend with them, we've already shown we can destroy you. You're super powerful. Let's the powerful be friends with the powerful. And I'm okay with that.
I want to clarify here. I agree with Janeway's argument that she makes throughout this episode. I completely agree with her. What I'm saying is, this is a 180 from Janeway earlier this season in Scorpion. I think she's being a hypocrite, but I agree with what she's saying here. I just disagreed with the way she handled the previous situation.
Well, the previous situation was an invasion with millions and millions and millions and millions, so it's a little bit different circumstances when it's millions versus one. I get what you're saying, though. And Ben, I'll actually clarify, I am with Janeway in this moment. Later on down the line is where I'm going to flip.
Well, the hunting party gets dressed and ready. Paris and the Hirogen exchange old hunting tales, and Chakotay rolls his eyes. Stomping through the corridor, Seven sees something. She shoots. She misses. Chakotay asserts himself as leader of this wolf pack and demands the Hirogen follow him. They locate 8472, floating midair, Yoda-style, but before they can stun it, the Hirogen starts firing. Tuvok shoots the Hirogen in the back, and we cut to... Apparently, Neelix has been in continued security training, because in the mess hall, Tuvok informs him it's time to trade in his spatula for a phaser. Neelix snaps to, just as Tuvok is contacted telepathically by Species 8472. We meet up in the corridor, and Tuvok explains the story of the wounded 8472 to Janeway and crew through his telepathic link.
Tuvok?
The creature initiated telepathic contact with me.
What's it saying?
Oh. ship was damaged during the conflict with the Borg. When the other members of its species retreated into fluidic space, it was left behind. It has been trapped in the Delta Quadrant ever since. Alone. Pursued by Hirogen hunting parties. It has no desire for further conflict. It only wants to return to its domain. It is dying, Captain.
Now, here again, the reason I included this clip is because A, it fills in the backstory for 8472, but B, after our Random Thoughts episode, I thought this was another example of playing a little bit fast and loose with the Vulcan telepathic abilities. I always thought they were touch telepaths, so it's a little strange for me to see that. I mean, the way he's acting, it's more like what I think of, you know, Betazoid telepathy a little bit.
I'm going to give credit to Species 8472 there. They have an extremely strong telepathic ability, so that's probably heightening Tuvok's ability.
And the
I
other...
wouldn't give it as much as Random Thoughts. That was just blatant overuse, but I would say Species 8472 probably has the talent to do it.
Well, why wouldn't the species on and Random Thoughts on that, that's all they are, is telepaths. I mean, wouldn't you think that they have that same sort of control and power as well?
The only thing is, too, I thought it maybe in Scorpion, then it, you know, maybe it should have been the Species 8472 talking to Kes and Tuvok. It was just Kes in that episode. So,
I think that the Species and Random Thoughts, their ability was so passive, as opposed to Species 8472, which is used more as a mechanism. They can turn it off and on. They probably use it mostly to communicate with one another, but... I mean, it's overpowering for anybody with a telepathic ability.
That's fair enough.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I wanted to note that I think it's really easy to turn Species 8472 into a sympathetic character, because our first experience with them, we have to remember that the reason they were responding the way they were was because the Borg had attacked them first. So really, they were defending their existence from the Borg originally. So I don't think it's such an emotional stretch for them to turn this character into a sympathetic character for us. We feel badly for it. It was left behind. It's been constantly hunted. It's beaten up and bruised and bleeding and dying. And I think it's a convincing argument that they make for it.
It's easier to frame them as sympathetic, though, when it's just one versus an invasion force, because the invasion force can be, like, their story can be sympathetic. Like, I know that they were attacked by the Borg first, but it's a lot harder to try to get some sort of sympathy with a bunch of aliens, like swarms and swarms of them trying to destroy you, versus this one wounded alien that just wants to get home. It's a much more... It's an easier leap to make in this situation than it was in Scorpion.
Right.
So did anybody have flashbacks to first contact with Data Picard when Tuvok and Seven are walking through the corridor, and Seven's not sure... she's feeling anxious. Something she probably wouldn't have a whole lot of experience with, I would assume, being the personality she is and where she comes from. I thought that was a nice... I'm not sure if that's an homage or anything like that, but I still think that's very humanizing to do that to her. I think it's good to have Tuvok in that role against her. You know, we've seen Tuvok and Seven before, and we know we've all agreed that's going to be a good relationship. I'm glad to see them continue it, but I'm also glad to see Seven afraid. That's something I haven't seen from her yet.
When you think about it, all of her encounters with 8472 before this was when she was part of the collective, and any fear that she may have felt would have been deemed as irrelevant, and she wouldn't have paid attention to it. Now she's forced to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So as a result of this story, Janeway realizes that what she needs to do is send 8472 home. But it's one tough talk after another for Janeway that afternoon. First, she argues with the Hirogen in sickbay, refusing to give him his prey. Next up, she goes for a round with Seven in her ready room. Janeway wants Seven to help them send the alien home. Janeway tries to convince Seven with a "when I was your age" story, but Seven isn't buying. In a moment of rather poignant hypocrisy, Janeway points out to Seven, "You don't sacrifice another life to save your own."
"I remember when I was a lieutenant. It was during a Cardassian border conflict. My away team was cut off while we were defending a Federation outpost. We've been exchanging phaser fire with a group of Cardassians for about 3 days. A stalemate. One night, during a break in the fighting, we could hear this low, moaning sound coming from somewhere in the brush. We knew that none of our people were out there, so it had to be a wounded Cardassian. You have to understand. We've been killing each other for weeks on this planet. It was brutal. But our commanding officer decided that we couldn't just sit there and listen to that poor man suffer. So he ordered me and an ensign to crawl out there and bring that Cardassian back to our camp. I thought he was crazy. He was risking our lives for someone who would have shot us without hesitation. But we did it. And the Cardassian lived. 3 days later, we secured the outpost. It was a major victory. We were all decorated by Starfleet Command. But in retrospect, the thing I'm most proud of was the night we saved that man's life.
Explain.
A single act of compassion can put you in touch with your own humanity.
You are trying to justify your present decision.
No. I'm trying to help you see this as an opportunity to grow. I know you don't want to do it, Seven. But I'm telling you as your captain and as your friend, you won't regret it.
No. Your decision is tactically unsound. We will be surrounded by Hirogen ships in approximately 2 hours. If we do not surrender the creature, they will destroy us. A lesson in compassion will do me little good if I am dead.
It is wrong to sacrifice another being to save our own lives.
I have observed that you have been willing to sacrifice your own life to save the lives of your crew.
Yes, but that's different. That was my choice. This creature does not have a choice.
It invaded our ship, put our lives at risk to save its own. In my view, it has already forfeited its freedom.
I'm giving you an order. Report to Deflector Control and begin working on creating a singularity.
I will not comply.
I think this shows us a big difference here. In each Star Trek, we encounter a character who is getting closer to being human. In Next Generation, it was Data. In DS9, it would be arguably Odo. In this episode, this shows what would happen if we were actively saying to Data, this is how you be human. This is what it takes to be human, and this is how you're supposed to be. When in reality, the character we relate to mostly in Voyager related to that aspect is the Doctor. He's doing everything himself to be more human. And I think we're putting too much on Seven right here. We're not letting her make her own decisions.
And plus, we're expecting her. I mean, she's still newly liberated from the Borg, and her experiences with 8472 are so recent. I think it's foolish on Janeway's part to think that she could just easily get over this quickly, and because this is what she's telling her to do. I think that's not the best decision that Janeway's ever made.
So, Melissa, can you explain the hypocrisy that you brought up?
Sure. So what Janeway is saying to Seven is that it would be morally wrong for them to sacrifice the life of this particular species 8472 to save themselves from the Hirogen. And yet this is the same woman who was willing to sacrifice their entire species to save her ship at the beginning of the season.
I don't necessarily see that, Melissa. Okay, so let me just kind of... Here's the difference between those two situations.
Go ahead.
I know we keep going back to Year of Hell over and over again. Two things. One, Year of Hell...
Not Year of Hell. Scorpion, you mean.
Scorpion. Sorry, mm-hmm. Thank you. They were never in any position to commit genocide. I think that's a misnomer. I think that's misidentified as their motivations or their abilities or anything like that. What they're trying to do is deliver a single punch that knocks their enemy back, gets them backpedaling, and then they are able to dart off and do what they need. So I don't quite see it in that light from that episode. Here, though, and yes, I do understand what you're saying, that Janeway has killed and will kill to defend herself. She's done it before, and she'll do it again. But this is an innocent creature in this situation. Its innocence is rooted in its helplessness. It's completely helpless. It's completely dependent on them for survival. And when you take on something that is innocent, think of a child perhaps, you would sacrifice anything for that being because they don't have a choice. They're not able to, you know, choose their own fate. So therefore, if you're in that position to choose their fate, you must choose their safety over yours. That's just the morally correct choice.
Right. I understand the latter half, Ben, but in Scorpion, the original deal that Janeway made with the Borg was, in fact, to give them a weapon that would wipe out the entire species of 8472. And that doesn't just include the combatants. That includes the entire species. All right. The non-combatants back at home, too. That was her deal. Now, it didn't work out that way because of circumstances, but that's what she agreed to do.
Well, that's right. The situation we were given when we had Hugh on the Enterprise.
And
you know,
Hugh
Picard
made it
was given the virus to destroy the entire Borg.
And he didn't do it.
And he was wrong to not do it.
Had he done it, we wouldn't have seven.
Well, maybe the Hansons wouldn't have gone to find the Borg.
Right.
Or would never have found the Borg. So, I mean, we can play all those games
forever. But anyway,
I'm
just saying, for Janeway, her in particular, I think she's being really hypocritical here. Or she's simply forgotten the decision that she made.
I agree with you. Janeway is being a huge hypocrite.
She's being a hypocrite, but I don't necessarily ding her for that. I mean, I know what you're saying, and it's valid, but I don't ding her for that because in life we're all hypocrites. You'd be lying to say if you ever made a decision that wasn't hypocritical with something that you had done before. So
absolutely. We're a race of do as I say, not as I do.
Right. And again, Ben, I agree with everything Janeway's saying in this episode. I think she's making the right decisions in this episode. I'm just saying she is not a morally consistent character.
Okay,
that's my argument.
Here's the thing, though. You guys are piling on a calling her hypocrite. First off, if I could just go back to one more time, she was never in a position to give genocide, number one. She never gave the Borg those things, number two. And I doubt her intentions, since they were never told, would ever be to do that. She knew she was making a deal with the devil. She would have said anything she needed to save, to deal with the Borg. She knew they weren't going to take their agreement, and vice versa. So, I mean, that's just all games there. That has no bearing on her moral consistency. Okay,
I'm sorry, Ben, but that's
it's
just
the Borg.
Not accurate.
No, it is accurate because the Borg is a different villain. It's not the same. The Borg is not a humanized mirror or anything like that. They are nothing but an artificial intelligence that is out there. It's a machine. It's a robot. We think of that differently. They don't have individuality. So therefore, we've talked about it that you need individuality and choice and self-determination in order to classify yourself like the way humans classify themselves. That's why the Borg are the greatest threat. They're not worried about being killed. They're worrying about losing their individuality. So the Borg are different. The way you deal with them are different. I don't think that you can look back on those episodes and draw any conclusions from them about Janeway's character. I really just don't think you can.
When we reviewed Scorpion, none of you disagreed with me that she was willing to commit genocide. You just disagreed with me on the fact that it was wrong.
I don't think I ever voiced my opinion about that particular statement. So Gina wasn't on that episode, so
I don't remember chiming in on that either. I was more focused on the other debate.
Well, go back and listen to the show.
I will. Homework for the night. But here, but back to hypocrisy. Janeway is not. I just don't get why you would possibly side with Seven here. She's a teenager. She's being irrational and emotional. She's afraid. She's making decisions based on her own feelings, not about
the
wisdom.
Ben, okay. What I'm saying is that Janeway is morally right, and I'm not saying that she's making a bad decision. What I think the bad decision is expecting Seven of Nine to go along with it.
Okay, now here's the thing, though. Seven's got to learn sooner or later. We've been talking about this since Message in a Bottle, that Seven is bucking authority. Janeway has to draw a line in the sand at some point here. Okay, she said, and you just crossed the line. Janeway trapped her into that. I mean, that was, hey, I mean, it's not like she knew Seven was going to say no, but she knew it was a possibility. And Janeway had to draw a line in the sand at some point. She's the captain. You follow her orders. Tuvok told her that before all the, in the last episode. She knew this was coming. We've seen this coming from Seven of Nine. Janeway had to have this confrontation. She had to force Seven into making this bad decision, disobeying orders and experiencing the consequences of what happens when you disobey orders. Every teenager needs to be grounded. Every kid needs to face consequences, okay? Otherwise, you don't bring them up correctly. Otherwise, you're not showing them the real world.
The part of the scene that emphasizes that is the very end. After Seven walks out, the look that Janeway has on her face. If she would have been just stone-faced and it would have said, "I'm the boss." Instead, she gives this, she shakes her head a little bit like she's exasperated, like she's a teenager and she's not actually leading, she's just going by her own emotions. But I wanted to go back a little bit on your point about how the Borg aren't individuals. How do you make a bad guy? You make a bad guy by giving them this faceless entity that's just pure evil, and they're all the same and they all have the same evil motivation. What do we know about Species 8472 except for their motivation? What do we know about the Hirogen except for their motivation? We haven't gotten a name from one of those characters yet. It's just the Alpha and Beta. That's it. They're all bad guys here, and they're just lumping them all in the same evil group, and that's why they're all the same.
I fundamentally disagree with that. I know that's how you start to make a villain. Those are what we call one-dimensional characters, and we build them into with more dimensions with episodes like these, where we give sympathy to 8472 and whatnot. It's just that the Borg will never.
They're instantly not evil. As soon as you get a character like Seven of Nine, who we're getting more like a human, it's not evil anymore. Once you give Hugh a name, he's not evil. Oh, he's okay. One of us. He gets along with us.
Well, what you're not allowed to do anymore once you get empathy, is you're not allowed to dehumanize anymore. Mm-hmm. That I agree with. I wouldn't say that would make you a good or a bad person, my ability to empathize with you, because I judge you based on the actions and your consistency of those actions. And so if you consistently try to kill me, I'm going to say you're not on my team, you're my enemy. I'm not going to say you're necessarily an evil bad guy, which is why you only have ever heard me and only ever will hear me say the Borg need to die and they all need to go away, because they are different than every other villain, every other enemy. Their motivations are totally different, and who they are is totally different, and what they are consisted of, the way they are built, everything is totally different. So that's just where I fall on that. I just fundamentally disagree.
So who would be more of a threat? Are the Borg more of a threat, or Thomas Riker and the Maquis?
The Borg, because Thomas Riker and the Maquis can't destroy the Federation. The Borg can't.
But they've been, I mean, aside from the fact that they've all been wiped out, every time we interact with them, again and again, they're attacking the Federation. They're stealing the Defiant. They're taking somebody out. There's nothing about their being, I don't want to say humanized, but anything other than their constant attacking us. That was your definition of somebody who's evil.
My definition of somebody evil, well, I just was flippantly saying, if you try to kill me all the time, you're my enemy.
That's what the Maquis are doing.
Well, I didn't say they weren't my enemy. I just said that they're humanized. But frankly, I mean, I know what you guys are saying. I just think that to call Janeway a hypocrite, a moral hypocrite, is just incorrect.
Define the problem, Ben.
When it comes to Janeway needing to lay down the law and create some boundaries for the adolescent Seven, I think you're absolutely right. And that's what Janeway does, and she sends Seven to her room. But you know what? When it rains, it pours. The Hirogen ships arrive and attack. 8472 wakes up, and he's angry, and Seven is ordered to head for the corridor with a dose of nanoprobes. Oh, and the Hirogen prisoner escapes sickbay and heads for his prey. Before they can sedate 8472, the Hirogen hunter shows up, and a fight ensues. Seven, fed up with this altruistic nonsense, programs a site-to-site transfer and beams the hunter and his prey to the Hirogen ship.
I'm being locked out. They're using Borg encryption codes. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, well, Harry Kim's always, as usual, useless. Now, let me go back to something that Ben was saying earlier. And Ben, I can kind of see what you're saying about Janeway and her not being a moral hypocrite. I mean, I do think she makes decisions that contradict some things that she said before, but I see your argument. Now, what I do want to touch upon is the whole purpose for what this whole exercise is to be. And so were you saying earlier that Janeway expected Seven to be defiant and want to get punished for it, so that way she can lay down the law and try to get her back on the straight and narrow?
Okay, here's what I'm saying. I have to put myself in these characters' shoes, and that's what I would have done.
That's what I would have done, too. See, this is the part where I said I just flipped over to Seven, is because the ship's about to be destroyed. You know, it's not good. All the weapons are down. The shields are failing. We're about to be blown out of the out of space. Maybe it makes me selfish. Maybe it makes me a bad person, Melissa. Maybe I'll go to hell in a handbasket for it. But I would have done exactly what Seven did. Mainly because, you know, it's that basic human need to stay, want to stay alive.
I don't think there's anything wrong with seeing it that way. The way I'm seeing it here is, if you're relating to anybody in this episode, it's Seven. And it's not supposed to be that way. That's not how the show is written. But because of the turn of events, possibly because of the acting, people are sympathizing with Seven, and they're relating to her more than any other character, making this episode seem like if you were in that character's shoes, the entire episode, everybody is against you.
Mm. And see, I have to say, though, that I put myself mostly into the shoes of Janeway in this episode as the parent, because she really is a mom in this episode. She's a mother to this adolescent daughter, and she's trying to help her through this situation, and all of the things about her past or her future as a character aside, just looking at her in this episode, she does a good job being a mom, I think. I really think she does. And you can really, she's got a huge problem on her hands with Seven, because, you know, she's been trying to nurture Seven's independence, and she's kind of maybe let it go a little too far. You know, everybody's been forgiving Seven and her abruptness and her breaking the rules and all of those things, and now she's got to pull her back, and it's not going to be easy.
Now, my question for Ben, going off this his point from earlier, do you think Janeway expected this end game end result, what happened, to happen when she brought Seven into this?
What do you you mean, when she first gave her the order, did she expect Seven to betray her in the end? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, do you think Janeway expected Seven to ultimately go with her own instincts in the end versus...
Oh, okay, maybe I see what you're getting at. Maybe that she goaded Seven into doing what Janeway wanted done anyway, and she made Seven do it, so she's a bad guy. Maybe that's what you're trying to say.
No, well, what I'm trying to
say
is...
That would be really complex and interesting.
It would be complex and excellent.
I don't know if I... Well, maybe I accidentally stumbled into a moment of brilliance, but what I was trying to...
Welcome to my world.
What I'm trying to ask you about is, you were saying earlier that... Janeway was using this particular instance in order to get Seven to lay down the law with Seven in order to ground. You said everybody needs to be grounded. So I thought maybe you were referring to the end scene where she actually is grounded, like grounded.
I think that, just to answer your question in a very broad stroke, I think Janeway's a captain. I don't think you get to be in that position without being a very intelligent person who is able to analyze many possibilities, and really good captains, really good leaders, arrange situations to occur so that no matter what decision the other makes, because they know they can't truly control what decision you make, but whatever decision you make will end up working out to the captain's benefit, or at least they can twist it into working into their benefit. But that's just the broad stroke answer I guess I can give you.
Right, okay, I kind of see what you're saying. What I was trying to ask about is that, you know, if that was indeed the case and she wanted to see how this would play out, then she's, you know, that would seem to go against her ultimate goal of trying to save this 8472's life, because she's risking on, you know, Seven's willingness to go along with her plan in order for this to work.
Yeah, and I think something that keeps this episode from being a really great episode is this problem of the ending. We had a lot of great material, and we haven't really talked, technically about the episode much at all, construction-wise or anything of that nature. This end is bad. It's a bad ending. It really is.
So, hey, Captain Ben.
Well, honestly, bad ending.
Bad? Could you explain to me what your reasoning is for bad? Because I like where the discussion at the end, though. I think it's incredibly poignant and it's an insight into the character dynamic between Janeway and Seven.
Right, right. I meant the end of the story, not the end of the characters. The end of the story of how Voyager gets away. It was the only way out they had. I mean, they had to go out that way. It was time crunch, story crunch, everything like that. And I just think that's a suffering that this episode has. But ultimately,
Seven makes a decision that I thought was consistent with how she was acting. I don't think it's bad in that sense.
Well, maybe. I don't know. But because we have to go back to the bridge first, and that's where Dad says to Mom, well, she's your daughter, and Mom is pissed. So we do end up going to our... Oh, by the way, if Janeway and Chakotay ever got married, I would have stopped watching this show.
So would I.
So in our final scene, Janeway heads down to the cargo bay. She wakes up Seven of Nine out of their alcove to confront her about her behavior.
When you first came to Voyager, I decided to grant you the same liberties and freedoms of any crew member because I wanted you to be a part of this family. And I've been willing to accommodate your unique way of doing things. Even when you rubbed somebody the wrong way or violated protocol. But this time I can't accommodate you. From this point forward, you will no longer have access to any primary systems on this ship, not without my direct authorization. If you attempt to circumvent me, I'll throw you in the brig. I still need your expertise in the astrometrics lab, if you're willing. If not, you can spend your time here in the cargo bay. Is that understood?
Yes. It is puzzling.
What's that?
You made me into an individual. You encouraged me to stop thinking like a member of the collective, to cultivate my independence and my humanity. But when I try to assert that independence, I am punished.
Individuality has its limits, especially on a starship where there's a command structure.
I believe that you are punishing me because I do not think the way that you do. Because I am not becoming more like you. You claim to respect my individuality. But in fact, you are frightened by it.
As you were.
Janeway loses all of her mom points here, in my opinion. It's not the, okay, you've learned your lesson, let's get along and move on. It's, I don't trust you at all, you can't do anything else anymore, you're barred. If you don't want to help out, stay in the cargo bay for 75 years, I don't care.
And here's the thing, I really like this ending speech, not because I think Janeway's doing the perfect things, you know. What I really like about this speech is what Seven says to her right at the end. I think that's an incredibly poignant point of view, and I kind of agree. I mean, I know it's a teenager's thing to say, like, you're just punishing me because I'm not like you, but at the same time, I mean, in certain parent-child dynamics, the parent kind of can treat a child coldly if they're not turning out the way they've always envisioned their perfect child to be. I mean, you know, there are certain parents who say to their children, oh, you're going to be this when you grow up, and you're going to do this, 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 and this. And when they don't agree or when they don't start thinking like them, they start treating them coldly or punishing them, in fact. So, you know, I can kind of see where Seven's coming from. Maybe,
I think the sign of a good parent, though, is being able to grow with your children.
Yes, and, I agree.
Okay, this is what you're doing.
I agree. I'm just saying that, unfortunately, sometimes these dynamics exist, and I think Seven makes a good point. That's all I'm trying to say.
I agree there.
I think the job of a parent is, I think your duty as a parent is to form your child to be a healthy adult. And I think one of the really tough lessons that we have to figure out, especially in adolescence, is that freedom and personal freedom is not meant to be the ability to do whatever the heck we want. Freedom is meant to be the ability to do what's right, to choose what's right. And as a parent, you have to teach your child how to do that, because that's a tough lesson to learn. And so I think Janeway is being a good mom in this last scene, because what Seven has done here is she's shown that she has a real, that her moral compass needs some adjusting. And that's something that Janeway should be really concerned about. So she has to give Seven time and space to think about that. And that's what they're going to continue to do over the next series of episodes.
I disagree with you there. I think that Janeway feels that right and wrong is something you're just born with the ability to know. And even though she may think that Seven's moral compass may need adjusting, Seven doesn't think so at all. She believes she was totally in the right and was doing what she would do as an individual, and Janeway's just slapping her down for it.
Yeah, and I agree. And me, not being a parent, but just from my point of view, there's a difference between trying to make your child into a healthy adult and making your child have the same belief and thought process that you do. And I think that Janeway's trying to go for the latter. So I agree. It's not a good idea to force your child to think exactly the way you do. They're not the same person. And there's plenty of things that my parents think and believe that I don't believe at all. I wouldn't question my morality on that.
Well, one might question the wisdom. I think that's kind of what the piece of the puzzle we're missing here. I mean, Janeway's imperfect in her reactions, of course. You should never let the sun set on anger. You should always break somebody down to nothing and then build them back up. She does the opposite. She builds her up then breaks her down. That's not the good way to go about it either. I think Seven is, of course, emotionally immature in this situation. She may be speaking the truth, but there are other ways to speak the truth if you want to get your way. I think overall what you guys are all talking about here is there's a lack of patience and wisdom between the two of them. And I think that that's very representative of many people's relationships when one person believes they have authority over another, but that other person doesn't believe they deserve that authority. And I think that's the dichotomy going on here. I think that's all really well done. I really enjoy it. I'm not here watching this show to judge whether or not the characters are necessarily consistently perfect or necessarily to see if they make the perfect moral decisions. I'm here to be entertained and have interest. And I think the drama's excellent.
And Ben, I'm not here for that either. I'm just saying.
No, I know. We're just discussing it. But
yeah, yeah.
I'm not trying to paint you guys as the opposite of what I said, however. I'm just saying what I'm here for. And so while we could talk about who's right, who's wrong, neither one of them are right. They're both absolutely wrong. First off, Janeway should have never put Seven in this situation. Like you guys said, I mean, I know she trapped her, and I support that because I think it's clever. I think it's one way to go about dealing with a hard-nosed person, trap them into their own issues and then... You know, but she didn't finish the way I would have because I would have tried to help them bring them up out of the mire instead of pushing them back down again. So I think everything you guys said are all right, actually. I really do. I think it's all correct. as much as we can all be correct.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes down to questions of morality, I mean, the only reason we're discussing this is because we're breaking down the episode. Ultimately, I'm here for the same reason you are, Ben. I like being entertained. And this is well-played drama. And and yes, the characters are flawed, but I like flawed characters. I think I've been saying that from day one. So,
well, I do like consistency in their choices. Like if I and they're sorry, not so much the choices, but the reasoning. I guess that's my thing. I like consistent reasoning and thought process.
I can appreciate that, but what I'm saying is I like it when characters make mistakes. Mistakes in wisdom, mistakes in morality, stuff like that, because it makes them, to me, it makes them more human, and it makes me able to relate to the situation more than, say, you know, in Next Gen when everybody just does the right thing because.
Yeah. Hello, Melissa. I'm so glad you went to the brig because Chakotay didn't come up at all, and that's a good thing.
I did my best.
Well, he's barely in this episode as it is.
I know. He has his tough guy moments, but we don't care. But that does it for us, though, I think. Unless anybody has any more, want to put the boxing gloves back on.
Oh, no, let's end this one.
Let's kiss and hug.
Yeah, okay. Before we do our little collective love session, we're going to move on to final thoughts and ratings. So, Melissa, our narrator, why don't you go first?
All right. This was a really good story. It had a lot of facets to it. The scenes between Seven and Janeway were very emotional. I mean, there was a lot of passion going on between those two women, a lot of anger and resentment and misunderstanding, and I thought that they did a good job of acting that, of of showing that. I think I'm going to give this episode 4 stars.
Okay. Gino, why don't you go next?
I watched this episode a couple times, and I tried to get out of it as much as I possibly could, and ended up finding myself arguing about smaller details because the main part of the story didn't grab me. When I tried to figure out what this story was about, I looked at the different roles that the different species played. Species 8472, which has been shown at this point to be an exponential more threat than the Borg, was the hurt puppy in this role. If this episode was anything, it was a story about what would have happened if the scientists got to E.T. before Elliot did. Now, when it comes to the Hirogen, they're the same characters we saw before. The hunt is mine, and you can't take it from me. And no matter how much we thought we were going to grow with their characters, it turned out to be the same thing at the end, and helping that guy survive did nothing. Yeah, the moments between Janeway and Seven seem to be poignant, but I don't think their characters grew any. I don't think their relationship grew any. They just beat each other down, and they're coming back to fight next week or whenever it is. Overall, if this episode came up again, I'd probably do dishes while I watched it. 2.5.
That's really harsh. I think that's undeserving, actually, but it's your score. Ben, what about
I you? Will disagree with your statement that this was the trilogy of awesome. This was the latter part of the Indiana Jones quote-unquote quadrilogy.
Oh, come on. This was not Crystal Skull, Ben. And if you think that, then I'm, to bring out an old expression of mine, you're just wrong.
I'm just wrong. I would prefer to be wrong in this series of episodes. Jeez.
But I don't say that stuff anymore. So, Ben, what about you?
I know, you're not quite so snippy and quippy as you used to be. Isn't that such an improvement? I don't think so. I like you the old way, Matt. However, I think you're probably right that this is a trilogy of awesome. I think mostly due to the intrigue and wonder that we've seen over these last 3 shows. I mean, we've seen a lot of new stuff, a lot of new ships, new aliens, new concepts. We've seen new characters do new things, new pairings. Specifically in this episode, the Doctor and Seven finally paired up now, and we'll see that continue on in much more detail. And it blossoms into a wonderful relationship between the two. So I like all the groundwork that this episode finishes laying down. It still suffers from a bit of a problem at the end. I just can't quite get over, because we've had this huge discussion. I mean, if you notice our discussion focused at the end of the show, it's because there's a lot of controversy there. I think that's because of the way the episode was, the way it was forced to end. I don't think Seven would have ever... probably should have made those decisions. I think Janeway probably should be forced into, having to do what she didn't want to do. I think that would have probably been a little bit better, since we're making these episodes better, of course, right? However, I still think it's quite entertaining. I will still watch it all the time, and I'll give it a 4.
Yeah, I think this is a... We'll have to keep track of this, Ben, but I think this is a flaw of Brandon Braga-written episodes is I think he likes to write himself into a corner and then not figure out... He can't really figure out how to get himself out of it without, in Year of Hell pushing the reset button, etc., etc. I mean, it's just a characteristic of his scripts that I find. But as far as this episode goes, I still say that this is the Trilogy of Awesome. Now, this is probably the Temple of Doom of the Trilogy of Awesome. Still not as good as the other two, but still solid. And what I liked about this episode, I really like. More Hirogen. I like the Hirogen, even though, yeah, we don't know much more about them by the end of this than we do before, but we're going to get a whole two-parter of them coming up soon, so I'm good with it for now. I like seeing 8472 back. It's an interesting dynamic that they give it in this episode, and I wouldn't necessarily go along with this dynamic for every appearance that they make, but with the story they want to tell in this episode, I think it works. And I really like the Janeway 7 stuff. I don't agree with all their wisdom and what they're trying to say, but I like seeing the struggle, and I like seeing Janeway trying to get a handle on how she's going to guide 7 through humanity, and 7 finally taking her first steps into individuality. And what I really liked mostly about this episode is that this is the first time in Voyager, that any of the crew has gone face-to-face with Janeway and told her no. Weak-ass Chakotay is not going to do that. I mean, if he does, he'll just get sent to the brig or his quarters or something with no supper. So this is the first time that someone has actually stood to Janeway and said, no, that's the wrong decision, and I'm not going to go along with it.
B'Elanna would do it, but she's hanging out in the sick bay with the doctor.
Well, B'Elanna would do it, like, in episode 2 when she was still Maquis. By episode 3, she's a good old, little Starfleet officer, which always bothered me. But, no, this is the first time that someone's told her, no, we're not going to do that. And actually, you're wrong on this call. So I like that. I think Janeway needs to be told on more than one occasion that she's not doing the right thing because she's so single-minded. She needs that counter-argument. So bearing all that in mind, I'm going to give this a 4, which is the lowest score I've given in this trilogy of awesome, but it's still good. I like this episode a lot, so I stand by that.
I think the reason I disliked it so much is because when I think about it, to me, it wasn't really Star Trek-y.
I disagree. This is very Star Trek-y.
Well, it didn't end wrapped up. This wasn't very episodic. If you end this episode, you know, and just come into it fresh, you're like, what are we starting from here? And wait a minute, everybody's not getting along by the end? You mean there's some tension on the ship still?
Oh, geez. Well, heaven forbid there'd be tension in a drama series.
Whoa. This is not drama. This is action drama.
Whatever. It's still the drama's still in it.
This is sci-fi action drama.
The fact that there's tension in this, that's a plus. I don't see that as a minus at all.
Well, I do agree with Gino though. Hold on, that ending on the positive note, I like those. Tend to like those more than ending on the downer note. So with Gino, I see what he's saying about the Star Trek the ending for sure. I definitely get that point.
That's just the Roddenberry treatment we've always been given.
Right, we've seen a lot, even in DS9.
As someone who doesn't.
I think a better way to have ended this would have been to never have that last conversation between Janeway and Seven. Just leave it with, like, a closing shot of Janeway at her desk and Seven in the cargo bay, and then take a whole episode next time and flesh that out. How are they going to deal with that? I think that would have been a better ending.
I agree. There needs to be some sort of consequences in dealing with this in future episodes, but I'm not going to go along with that because I don't necessarily like the Roddenberry ending all the time. In fact, I sometimes embrace the anti-Roddenberry ending because I think it can make things interesting. So that's
I'll go with you there. I just think the two plots weren't so cohesive. They got together for one point, but didn't really mesh.
Yeah, maybe, that's a fair point, actually. Maybe I could go along with that more than the ending.
Yeah, the ending isn't what killed me on the episode. It was the fact that we had the Hirogen and Species 8472, and the focus is on the fact that Seven doesn't get along.
Yeah, okay. No, Gino, that's fair.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I don't necessarily agree 100%, but I go along with that more, and I can see where you're coming from on that. So welcome to the feedback section. This time we have two episodes to get through. Our feedback comments from the episodes Waking Moments and Message in a Bottle. We'll start with the one comment we got on Waking Moments. Ben, do you want to read that?
Sure. It's from Takaran Golem, and he says, I'm first! I have the power! Sorry, guys. But
I think you just overlooked. I think you just burst everyone's eardrums.
I sure hope so. So in the beginning of the episode, Janeway is about to call a staff meeting when they realize that Harry is still in bed. Did anybody else expect Janeway to move the staff meeting to Harry's room just to jokingly teach him a lesson? A missed opportunity. So that's two episodes in a row where Chakotay does a good enough job, in my humble opinion at least. Not great, not fantastic, not award-winning, not as good as his peers on set, but good enough to get the job done. I've actually struggled over my opinion of Chakotay's spirituality. On one hand, I never found it very engaging. On the other hand, I always wondered if it was a bit of ethnocentrism on my part. I find my own heritages, mythology fascinating, but sometimes other people's just aren't. But I think you hit on something interesting here. Chakotay's tribe was always intentionally vague to make it more accessible, but it did just the opposite. We couldn't ever learn anything about it, and little did we learn it. The little we did learn was inconsistent. And it has to be said, lumping all Native American tribes' mythology together does seem unintentionally racist. Perhaps it would have been a much better idea if he had one defined tribe that we could learn the intricacies of and viewpoints of that tribe, and make sure that it's authentic and not the Hollywoodized crap. Anyway, I like this episode. It's not perfect, but it's a reality-bending thriller episode and a niche genre that I love. Miss Melissa and Gino, and P.S., I simply have to check out this bridge. It sounds like a happening place. To which I said the brig is smelly. And yes, it is. And don't go there. We can smell it all the way up at the bridge. It's quite gross.
Especially when Gina's
said I cleaned it up.
All I'm saying is we need to create a type of ambiance down there that shows that you're being punished for being in the brig. If it smells good, there's no point.
Yeah. I do think, though, that tack is, you know, hitting the nail on the head here about Chakotay. I mean, just across the board, he had a very inconsistent, you know, background story, I guess. I know he's part of Maquis, but it seems like his dealings with it were a little weird, and his tribal stuff doesn't really make any sense, and maybe it is unintentionally racist. I don't know. But either way, it's not very good.
No, it isn't very good, and I think what they tried to do with Chakotay is kind of what they tried to do with original series people, where Sulu and Uhura were meant to represent all of Asia and all of Africa, respectively. The difference being, of course, is that in TOS they didn't have, I don't know, Sulu always eating rice or whatever. You know what I mean? They didn't throw every stereotype against the wall and to illustrate that they were their ethnicity. And
I think what it's doing, it's kind of unintentional racism in that it's reverse racism. You're trying to show somebody as much respect as possible, that when you point out any aspect of their civilization in at least the way they've done it, it seems kind of cartoony, like they're parroting the entire society. And instead of making it respectful, you're just kind of poking fun at it because you're not being accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I ultimately think that's the big problem with it.
That's why you never go as somebody you know as Halloween.
And thank you, Tack, for holding the torch high for Chakotay.
We never go anyone as high as someone we know as Halloween. Then, damn, I'm going to have to give back my baseball hat and not get my redneck haircut. I was going to go as Ben this Halloween.
Thanks.
I'm going to walk away from that one.
Anyway, we're going to move on to our message in a bottle thread. First comment here is from our loyal poster, Medic1849, otherwise known as Blair. He says, "A great podcast, guys. This episode was such a great episode. The chemistry between Picardo and Dick was really natural. It also felt right coming back from being back in the Alpha Quadrant. It was like being away at college and coming home for Thanksgiving dinner with your family. I, too, saw this episode as turning the corner. I was so happy that Starfleet finally knew that they were alive and could start looking for ways to get them home. As we will see in the next episode," which he was actually on, "they follow this amazing news with some harsh realities. Your in-depth discussion of the Doctor's additions were so funny. As one who works in the medical field, I have yet to find any protocols or procedures that require such additions. Must be a Starfleet thing. By the way, didn't the Doctor have children in the episode where he was stuck on the planet and Voyager was seen as a light in the sky that was worshipped, and the planet that was out of sync with the rest of the galaxy," which he's referring to Blink of an Eye, the season 6 episode. Mm-hmm. In that one, I thought that, I don't know, I know he has, he calls someone a son, but we never found out if it was his biological son or not. It might have just been a stepfather thing.
I don't think holographic DNA really meshes with anything else.
Right.
Either.
That's how I interpreted it. But thanks so much, Blair, for your comment. We always love reading this stuff for you. And yes, we had quite a fun time discussing the Doctor's additions, or at least Ben and Gino did.
Next up, we've got a letter from Tech. He says, "I just need to get this out of the way. I find Andy Dick to be nails on a chalkboard annoying. Yeah, I said it. What? Did you expect me to go along with the group? Okay, fine. I liked him in this episode, but that changes nothing between us. I think he toned it down for his performance here, and it worked to great effect. By the way, Bashir was going to be an LMH, not the EMH Mark II.
Ooh.
Well, no, I think the LMH program ultimately morphed into an EMH Mark II because there never was an LMH, so technically I'm still right.
I do have a non-conspiratorial theory I'd like to share. Let me know just how wrong I am. I think Melissa, in her boundless empathy, cannot think of the Doctor as anything other than a person. Did you hear that?
I'm sorry, I think I had to laugh there for a second. Some boundless empathy.
My boundless empathy. Could not think of the Doctor as anything other than a person. From his first activation, he was a fully formed person, and to be fair, they did get a human being to play him, and one with a lot of personality and charisma. That's why she's surprised to find out that he was created without his Willy Wonka. Why create a person and leave out the essential parts of humanity?
I'm going to back up away from my mic for this one.
You're wrong!
Okay, we're good now.
That wasn't me who said that, by the way.
Gino, which part was he wrong about? The boundless empathy?
All of it. Every single part of it. Especially the doctor's Willy Wonka. His hoo-ha is a non-important piece of his anatomy that a doctor does not need. Again, tell me why a doctor would need that if he's a hologram.
Well, you know what? I tell you something, Gino. I got you. And close your ears, Melissa, and all those other family-friendly listeners. He's a great service device, don't you think?
That's why you have a holodeck.
Ew.
Oh, give me this service device.
Well, it's just a doctor. He has that little back office, you know? I mean, can't he opaque the windows and close the door? You don't need to use too much energy for that, and the holodeck can remain free for Captain Proton. Well,
at least I consider the doctor to be more sophisticated than what you find on the holodeck. To use a very crude metaphor and try to keep it family friendly, what you find on the holodeck is little more than mannequins that you insert oxygen into and then do things with.
That's or more hollow sweets than anything, but yeah. Don't give me a fully anatomical doctor. If anything, he'd have been floating head doctor.
Well, you know what, Gino? Even if you were on that ship, you're not going to be doing anything with him, so what does it matter?
Yeah, take that.
Hey, it's a long trip home.
Well, boys, Tak personally thinks that this makes sense if you think of him as a flat, temporary tool only for emergencies. He's not going to have relationships, free time, or even the will to pursue happiness. That was a very nice little reference there. I like that, Tak. I'm sure the only reason he was given any personality at all was because Zimmerman would not let a great holographic feat of engineering go without personality, lest he be mistaken for a hack. Mm. That's also why he didn't bother finding a model with good bedside manner. He considered personality to be irrelevant as long as it does its job, much like his own outlook on life. Regardless, great discussion and great episode.
I'm going to agree with you there that, yes, he's an engineer, so he didn't care about personality, but if you pay attention to the episode where he was trying to convince Bashir to be the next hologram, he's saying that he was more focused on creating the program, and that's why he wanted Bashir to be the next one, because of his personality.
I'm afraid this model lacks your scintillating personality. I love that episode.
Well.
What's next, Gino?
I don't even know.
It's Jarek. You're supposed
it's
to be on this.
It's from Jarek. He says, love the show, and that's one of my favorite episodes of Voyager as well. Robert Picardo is supremely talented, and we've been blessed to have him grace the sci-fi genre via Star Trek and Stargate. I don't know much about Andy Dick, but I can't imagine anyone better suited to that role. And certainly interesting to see who replaced Julian as the template for the new EMH.
Which Tak replies to, my nerdiness compels me to point out that Julian was supposed to be a model for the LMH long-term medical program, holo program, so the Andy Dick character was not so much the alternate model as another project altogether.
And my nerdiness compels me to point out that the LMH was abandoned and it went to AMH Mark II, so technically it's still the same program.
Did you read that in a book? Because I don't remember that being canon.
And we never saw an LMH, did we? Who says they can't make more than one type of hologram? The Prometheus was an experimental ship altogether. You've got experimental programs going out. Why not put all your experimental stuff on the ship to see what works and what doesn't?
Yeah. Well, I still don't understand why I just have a robot do all the searching anyway. So, Batak Paul goes on to be our final commenter on the episode. He says, an amazing episode of Voyager. This hit every note of my Star Trek chord. The ships, the comedy, and the story all played in perfect pitch. And like you guys pointed out, this episode was not afraid to poke fun at the series as a whole. The network, to me, never made sense as, even if all the nodes are connected, the network being the relay network that the Hirogen were using, that never made sense to me. Because even if all the nodes are connected, you still have to take into account the time it takes for the information to travel between nodes. Silly, I know, but I had to pick fault with something. Also, with the extent of this network, why would they not try and hack it again? And if Starfleet placed a vessel at the edge of the Alpha Quadrant, could they not have sent a transporter signal through the network? I'm confused.
You've got a lot of issues to bring up here, Paul. First of all, even if all the nodes are connected and you still have to take into account the time it takes, yeah, that's why we had an episode between when we got an episode and when we got our next thing. Now, granted, it's sending a holographic signal. They had to bounce him along that, but that's why the message went through. They couldn't send a voice message, but the holographic signal was more direct, which is why they got it to the ship before it got out of range. If you're talking about the extent of the network and why they wouldn't try to hack it again, they were out of range between the next receiving 41
seconds.
System. I mean, not even that, but between when the network went down, I guess we're reading Message in a Bottle, but the episode that happens afterwards, when the singularity takes effect and just smashes that one system, yeah, they could try to hack it again, but in this case, they're way far away from another relay station to even try that. The Hirogen are blocking them at every turn. And if Starfleet placed a vessel at the edge of an Alpha Quadrant, could they not have sent a transporter signal? They talked about that.
Did they?
Yes, that's why they said only a holographic signal could get through so well.
So take that, Paul.
Yeah, and besides, better to risk a fake boy than a real boy. I'm not sending Tom Paris through that relay network.
Wow, you are really technologist.
I'm just saying, send Chakotay. If it works, great. If not, sorry, dude.
Oh, come on.
Well, you know, send Chakotay. If that doesn't work, send Kim after him.
I say send Kim first, honestly.
Transporter signals somewhere? Can't we just, like, re-transport her out of, you know, replicator rations and send her off?
It's the hair of a hairbrush. Yeah, but see, Neelix burned all her stuff when she broke up with him, so there were no more, like, hair and hairbrushes or anything else to recreate.
Mr. Vulcan, can you send this out of the transporter tube? Let's see what happens if you fire this like a photon torpedo directly into a star. What would happen?
The Ferengi would have tricked the Voyager into trying to get a cheap way home to the Alpha Quadrant. There's a future reference for you there.
Well, they do later on, but... Mm-hmm. That's for way down the line when we get to season 7. But until that time, you can reach us through many different ways here at the Delta Quadrant, including email at our email address at deltaquadrantpodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach us through Twitter at our handle is Delta Quadrant Cast, QUADT_cast. You can reach us through Facebook.com at facebook.com/the Delta Quadrant. But TrekMate is not the only way you can listen to the Delta Quadrant. What's that other method again, Gino?
That other method would be Trek Radio. That's a great resource to listen to all sorts of Star Trek radio-ness on the internets. And we actually air on Thursdays at Eastern, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's U.S. Eastern Time.
Was that TrekRadio.net, Gino?
Yes, .net.
.net. Don't make that mistake, folks. But until next time, this concludes the Trilogy of Awesome. And yes, Gino, I still call it a trilogy. But this concludes
whatever.
The Trilogy of
Crystal Skull.
No. Sorry, that just is not correct. But until next time, guys, where we pick up with the episode Retrospect, this is Matt in Arizona closing Hailing Frequencies.
And this is Ben in Arizona saying, shut up, Gino!
And this is Melissa from North Dakota saying goodnight, everybody.
This is Gino in Oklahoma. No.
Thanks for listening to the Delta Quadrant Podcast. Visit TrekMateFamily.com or email DeltaQuadrant@TrekMateFamily.com for more information. Delta Quadrant is a dedicated Voyager podcast that's reviewing every episode of Voyager until Voyager gets home. Thanks for listening.